session number 30304.
Ted Rayner, reel 32.
So we got back to Reykjavik a little more quickly than we had left it, and we were very pleased to be there and discovered that Kaldidanus was no longer available as an airfield. So we were operating from Reykjavik together with one or two other different types of aircraft with different tasks. But one thought was uppermost in our minds, that of all times to attempt to start anti-U-boat operations from Greenland, the month of January was the worst possible choice. The weather not only affected our operations, but inevitably led to a build-up of American transit aircraft unable to fly the next stage on their way to the UK. Pragmatists might argue that it was a response to dire need, perhaps a cri de coeur from the US command, which had lost troop ships to U-boats in those waters. Strategists would counter that it showed a fatal lack of foresight. I realized that I had begun a purely academic exercise for two reasons. Firstly, even if the time had been more propitious for ideas to be implemented, it would have been necessary to find a higher-ranking mouthpiece than myself. And secondly, it would have been essential to overcome the lethargic approach to the problem of the Greenland gap, consequent upon the belief that the very long-range Liberator aircraft would shortly be able to cover the whole of the Atlantic from bases on both sides of the Atlantic. And this belief was encouraged by the promise of getting VLR aircraft operational in sufficient numbers at a faster rate than proved possible, and was accepted in the expectation of full cooperation between the Allied commands. And this took longer than expected to materialize. And, of course, one of the subsidiary reasons, perhaps, I say subsidiary because it should have been more easy to solve, was between Coastal Command and Bomber Command. Four-engined aircraft were wanted by both commands. And once Bomber Command had started on its great mission against German targets, no doubt it was difficult to stop it, particularly with an Air Chief Marshal such as Air Marshal Harris in charge. But I certainly understood that the dates by which Coastal Command was meant to get its very long-range Liberator aircraft were not met. But on the other hand, the tragic loss of Merchant Navy personnel, which were to total 33,000 men lost by the end of the war, should have been sufficient evidence to show where the four-engined aircraft could operate to most effect. And as to mention Richards and Saunders again, the prime need was simply to abolish the gaps. From August to October 1942, an average of nearly 500,000 tons went down each month in the North Atlantic alone. Worse still, new U-boats continued to come into operation very much faster than the old ones could be destroyed. Although this focus came some years after the events, it was painfully self-evident at the time, not least on the operations board of Headquarters Coastal Command. Someone there would certainly have been wrestling with the problem, as I was in my lowly state, trying to justify criticism of the operations we had been ordered to abandon. If BW-1 could have been used as an anti-U-boat base at the start of the U-boat wolf pack tactics in the summer of 1942, what aircraft did the RAF have which could have been used beyond their accepted limits in an emergency operation until the very long-range liberators actually became available? Well, of course, there was the Hudson, and sometimes forgotten, its range and endurance could be enhanced by greater flexibility. As there was no necessity, no complete necessity, always to go out on patrol armed with depth charges, and the supplementary petrol tank could be installed in one or two of the aircraft, and with that extra supply we could have covered much more of the gap than we were able to, even in the worst of weather, because that addition would probably have given us the endurance so that if a message from a Greenland base was to the effect that there was no opportunity to return there to a safe landing, we would probably have, it could be simply proved, we would probably have enough fuel for us to reach Gander in northern Canada, which was the airfield from which the Hudsons were, and other aircraft, were leaving to fly to Greenland. There was the Wellington aircraft, which had proved itself with bomber command and could extend its range also. It was not unknown to reach an endurance of 12 hours with a bomb-reduced load from 2,000 to 1,000 pounds. That would give enough opportunity for four 250-pound depth charges, which was, after all, the normal load for a Hudson, and therefore some aircraft could be armed and still have the length of range necessary. The Whitley, which had been used in bomber command, were not well liked, to say the least, but it had even a greater endurance as such when it could fly at about 100 miles an hour than the Wellingtons. Both aircraft in the role needed could be enhanced by judicious reductions in ancillary weight. These three types of aircraft would have had no difficulty in using the long, wide runway at Bluey West 1, a fact well proven by a number of larger four-engined aircraft, such as the one I couldn't remember earlier, the Lockheed Constellation, which we saw there during the day. And of American aircraft, the Mitchell, the one that flew off the aircraft carrier to bomb Tokyo on the 18th of April 1942, and Boeing Flying Fortress, obviously well known to us. Indeed, why was an airfield so strategically placed, not used by anti-U-boat aircraft as soon as the site was made into a landing ground, so that when the Boeing Flying Fortress even entered the American Air Force, one would think the Navy, the American Navy, would be crying out for them. And the overriding importance was simply to get the aircraft, even inadequately armed, into the air around the convoys. And so one came to a conclusion. Iceland, occupation 1940, Foresight, Greenland, occupation 1941, foredoomed, so far as protection for naval craft was concerned. And thirdly, the type of introspection that we, or retrospection that we were all talking about, we covered much of the case made by several war historians in RAF volume 1939 to 45, volume 3, written with full access to official documents. Hillary and George Saunders, who was, after all, sometime librarian of the House of Commons, outlined the procedures designed to put Allied aircraft over and around the Atlantic convoys for which the Royal Navy was responsible. And I've mentioned one or two of these already, but just to give you a list which in itself is sufficient to know how much hot air there was that was never adequately cooled down. There was the Anti-U-Boat Subcommittee of the British War Cabinet, which handled all matters of policy and which could take the decisions which any ministry or HQ would be obliged to carry out. From the US entry into the war, Coastal Command pressed for a unified command in the North Atlantic. The US Naval Staff in London agreed. The chief of the United States Navy did not. Air Marshal Slessor, on taking over Coastal Command, again emphasized that the North Atlantic was one battlefield in which the Allies had to counter the flexibility of enemy forces, possibly only by equally flexible defense and an integrated system of control. The Allies came near to falling into an error as old and hoary as war itself, Saunders suggests, to have great strength available in what, to each separately, were important points, leading to too many anti-submarine craft in some places, for instance the east coast of the US, and too few at others. An Atlantic Convoys Conference held in Washington agreed procedures which were never adopted. Its offspring, the Combined Procedures Board, produced a combined scheme. Then the American Navy Department stepped in and prevented its implementation. Then an Allied Anti-Submarine Board, two British and two American officers, as I think I've mentioned, produced a number of recommendations as a result of touring anti-submarine commands. They were ignored. And the problem explanation, as this state of affairs suggests Saunders, was that the U.S. Navy was far more concerned with the great sea and air campaign in the Pacific, and they kept powerful anti-submarine forces in the areas close to their own Atlantic seaboard. So Admiral King Admiral King of the U.S. Navy and his staff did not view the Battle of the Atlantic in the same light as General Marshall, the U.S. Army, viewed the invasion of Europe in 1944. Hence, BW-1, major role, Army aircraft to Europe, minor role, Navy for U.S. convoys. During the month of May 1943, U-boat losses reached a peak. It was the turning point, and it could have been earlier. The Germans analyzed the causes of those losses and found that 35% occurred when in transit to and from the operational area, and all these sinkings were by aircraft. In the operational area, the open Atlantic, total losses were 26%, due in equal part to air attack and naval attack. Total losses when in action against a convoy rose to 38%, the majority of the sinkings being by escort vessels. By proper use of the Greenland base, U-boat losses around convoys in that area would have been greater and Allied shipping losses fewer. And as a consequence of waging total war, the essentially friendly population of enemy-held ports such as Lorient, Saint-Nazaire and Brest suffered heavy air bombardment, for the huge shipping losses in mid-Atlantic at the end of 1942 caused the Allied leaders at the Casablanca Conference of January 1943 to order retaliation in force against the source of U-boat patrols. One more result of failure to minimize the opportunities for U-boat attack in the Atlantic. Failure to make the most of Bluey West. So, back in Iceland, after our Greenland adventure, we learned that the Germans had begun to fit snorkel breathing tubes to existing U-boats and then to rearm with larger and faster boats. The snorkel allowed a U-boat to charge its batteries at periscope depth whilst being driven at dead slow on its diesel engines, so that during the vital manoeuvre only a few feet of tube showed above the water. Well, snorkels could be fitted in the safety of U-boat pens in Brittany ports, such as I've just mentioned recently. The new larger U-boats had to come from German ports, reaching the operational area by passing through between UK and Iceland. The deterrent effect of the sorties we carried out was in their frequency during the long summer days. And Admiral Dönitz had then sent to his U-boat commanders a message on the 17th of May, I think it was, 1943, and I remember the message number, 1769. The situation in the North Atlantic now forces a temporary shift in operations to areas less endangered by aircraft. But all this meant that in July, July 1942, out of 115 U-boats sighted in the Atlantic area, 88 were in transit through the Bay of Biscay, and we had only one sighting unsinking in our water throughout the period. So 88 out of 115 didn't leave us many coming through our area, and we didn't have much fun because there was really nothing more than the weather to contend with.
Which area were you patrolling, Ted, around
Iceland? Both to the west of Iceland and to the east. The west was obviously going southwest from Iceland. We were actually covering convoys, either escorting them or patrolling ahead or doing searches. But also, of course, as I mentioned when I was talking about the ice reconnaissance, we had the Denmark Straits to think about. But by this time, of course, at this stage of 1942, the Russians were desperate for material, and we all know the stories of the Navy's great efforts to get supplies through to Murmansk. So patrols that we did to the east of Greenland were really searches for possible U-boats and to show a presence of aircraft for those convoys taking the stuff to Russia. In fact, there's a very rather strange sequel to that effort, because we were not really aware of the significance of them at the time. But I think it's about 6 or 7 years ago, certainly when circumstances allowed us to be more friendly with the Russians, and they were feeling more friendly toward us. Those who had carried out these patrols with 269 Squadron suddenly received two campaign medals from the Russians. We were completely taken aback by these because we didn't know they were coming. And I had to contact one or two blokes to see whether this was general or what. And they were in an unusual shape, not sort of hanging down as our medals do, but in the shape of a V. So they're in a bottom drawer somewhere, but certainly that was rather nice of the Russians after all that time. must have had something to do with their celebrations of their great victory, I suppose.
How long did you carry out these patrols for? Was it, you said the summer, was it? What was the length of your tour at that stage?
Well, we were usually in the air for about 8 hours. we had an endurance time of more than that, but the weather was always a problem, and particularly going towards the east because of the high land in Iceland is to the east of all both the landing grounds, the Calderdanes, which by this time, of course, we must remember, was out of action because it had been closed after being flooded. So Reykjavik and then Keflavik, the American base, were really the only two in the southwest corner. So we had to allow a certain amount of endurance time in case it was needed for that purpose to get down there. Anyway, on a bright summer, midsummer day, I was detailed to take a Hudson, which had only 1.5 engines, they put it, down to the UK for overhaul. And the fact that we would carry passengers on leave was of little concern. I had complete belief, faith in the aircraft's single-engine flying capability. But for my return to Iceland, I was instructed to collect an Anson aircraft and fly it there in three stages, so it could be used for communication duties throughout the island. And before I could depart for Iceland, I had to collect items needed for these minor modifications. Well, I think I did about half a dozen takeoffs and landings involving much taxiing, and I was finally airborne for the return journey to Wick in the evening. That's after picking up from, I don't know whether it was obvious or not, picking up these things from maintenance units in England and going up to Wick before leaving the next day. And by the time I got up to Wick, I remember it was about 10 o'clock. And of course, I remember in wartime we had a double extension of daylight hours. And so it was reasonably light. And the runway lights were already on in the half light. So I remember taxiing carefully along the perimeter track. The lead-in lights were not yet showing. As I passed the control tower towards the hangars, which, with my hand on the brake lever below the throttle quadrant, I could feel the air pressure which operated the brakes was insufficient unless the lever was almost at the top of its travel. I became very much aware of one of the deficiencies of the Anson aircraft, not previously causing any concern, but the fact that the air bottle from which the brakes were pneumatically operated had to be inflated by external means, as there had no engine-driven compressor, which, of course, I've been so completely used to, never gave a thought about the pressure needed in other aircraft. Well, perhaps I should have been a pessimist and thought of the air bottle as three quarters empty rather than a quarter full. I remember as I turned towards the hangars, the dim figure of a guiding airman appeared in the gloom. And after moving a few yards in his direction, he waved his arm vigorously towards the hangar on my right. Doors open, lights shone powerfully inside it, so that the figure in front of me was nothing more than a silhouette. And it was obvious that this was the hangar where the modifications were to be done. "Poor chap," I remember thinking, "waiting for me to turn up at this time of night. I'll get as far as I dare, so that'll be easier to put the Anson in." And with the engines hardly ticking over, and the brake lever now at the top of its travel, giving faint but so far just adequate pressure on the brakes, the aircraft slowly approached the hangar. Then the snail's pace gradually started to increase. So I immediately cut the engines, again applied fully what remained of the brake pressure. This time, no response. I had a desperate look at the gauge, still the same. Then realized that, although still moving very slowly, the pace was increasingly, inexorably. And it suddenly occurred to me that there was a slight slope from taxi track to hangar which had been indiscernible in the twilight against the blinding flood of light from the hangar. And as the Anson's remorseless trundling continued, I could see that a space had been prepared beyond the open doorway for the aircraft. Inside, various aircraft were parked in tight formation, and by now the shepherding airman, he became an amazed bystander as the inevitable drama unfolded. Throughout what seemed an age, I tried to think how I might help these determined wheels to stop revolving. First, putting down the flat lever in the down position in the forlorn hope that they might be lowered by a rapid use of the hand pump in time to cause additional drag. And meanwhile, I was holding the control column as far back as possible in an attempt to add still more drag.